You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Good evening. My name is Ila Jaberi, and I'm the president of the Council of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. It is my great pleasure to welcome you all to this evening, which has been co-produced by the Council and the Library Foundation's Aloud program. We needed a big tent to share this evening's interview between Daniel James Brown and Tom Ikeda, not simply because we have a best-selling author, but because his story is stirring, timely, and inspiring. Many of you are already familiar with Daniel James Brown. His previous book, Boys in the Boat, a New York Times number one bestseller about nine working class boys from American West who showed the world in 1936 Olympics in Berlin what grit is really like. And if American grit is the theme, his book, Facing the Mountain, fits perfectly. This book traces the Japanese-American thread woven into the tapestry of America at this critical point in our history. Goodreads calls this book a gripping World War II saga of patriotism and courage. Tonight, we will hear about the 442nd Battalion, a regimental combat team, a special Japanese American army unit who overcame the most difficult, brutal odds in Europe. And all this during a period when their families were incarcerated back at home. It is also the story of a brave young Japanese American who refused to surrender his constitutional rights, although it meant imprisonment for him. So many kinds of patriotism and courage in this book. Daniel has also written other remarkable books, Indifferent Stars Above and Under a Flaming Sky. He is a master at bringing compelling historical events to life. He taught writing at Stanford University and San Jose State University. We are very grateful to Tom Ikeda for being with us this evening. He's a good friend of Daniel, and he wrote the foreword to his book. As executive director of Denshaw, a nonprofit based in Seattle, Tom works to collect, preserve, and share Japanese American history. He is a sansei, a third generation Japanese American who was born in Seattle and grew up there. And he has a special connection to this history, as his parents were among those incarcerated during World War II. I cannot think of a more perfect interlocutor for this conversation this evening. And now I'd like to welcome Daniel and Tom. Thank you both for being with us this evening.
Ila, thank you so much for those introductions. As you can see, Dan and I are together. We're in Seattle. We're in a, just looking around, we're actually in a studio at the Denshaw offices where we've interviewed hundreds of people, Japanese Americans. And it's been fun, telling Dan about this. And we have a little green screen back here. So that's why we have a picture of Mount Rainier. And it's been fun that I just want to mention, both Dan and I have been fully vaccinated. So, that's why we can be kind of, not socially distanced right now with masks. But we've also been doing quite a few Zoom meetings. So it's kind of fun just actually being together.
It is, yeah. All those back and forths with Zoom, worrying about technical glitches. This is more natural and more fun.
Yeah. So, to start off, last week, the book came out.
Yep.
And it's been, I think, about 10 days or so. What What's been the response? And in particular, anything interesting that surprised you in terms of a comment, a question about the book?
You know, it's off to a good start. I mean, the book's getting really good reviews, and I couldn't be more pleased about how it has unfolded in the last 10 days. I don't think anything in particular has surprised me, except that the sheer volume of interest that it has already attracted. I mean, that's very reaffirming to me after 5 years of working on it. It's nice to see a lot of people showing a lot of interest.
Mm-hmm. But I was looking at your schedule, and you're going to all these different regions, you know, Boston, Atlanta, Tulsa, Seattle. Any differences in terms of the questions or the type of knowledge people have?
I think there's definitely more knowledge on the West Coast than in other parts of the country. I mean, those of us that grew up in the West Coast, and whether it was Seattle or the Bay Area or Los Angeles, you know, I think for the most part have some awareness of the Japanese American story during World War II. I find that as you go further east, with some exceptions, it's less known. They're sort of the fundamentals of the experience. So I do notice differences in the questions in terms of just of the amount of detail that people come to the story with.
Okay, let's get into the making of the book. But before I do that, I just want to congratulate you that yesterday I was informed that although it's just the first week, your book's on the New York Times bestsellers list. So congratulations, yeah, that's pretty cool.
That's always a good thing. I mean, that's one of the things that you hope for, that, you know, in that first week or so, first 10 days. So I was very happy to see that.
Oh, you're so casual. That's such a big deal. So yeah, I want to share with the audience, you know, kind of, you know, how, you know, in some ways the genesis of this book. And 5.5 years ago, you know, Dan and I met in Seattle. We were at a, you know, Mayor's Arts Award, and Dan was receiving an award for The Boys in the Boat. And I was pretty excited to actually meet you. You know, The Boys in the Boat is one of my favorite books, and it's because of the style. I mean, you know, are this incredibly great storyteller, but it's real history. And you know, the idea of meeting you, because I was thinking, here I've been collecting these stories for decades, and I think the stories are compelling, but they needed a storyteller to weave them together. But I was really excited because, you know, on that day when we were on the stage, you know, I was receiving an award for Densho because for 25 years we've collected and preserved the Japanese American story, yeah, and shared that. But I was genuinely surprised that you were interested in the Japanese American story.
Mm. Well, I think I always have been. My father worked in the flower business in San Francisco. We had a lot of Japanese American friends and business associates. So even as a child, I was interested, you know, in that piece of history. But it wasn't really until, you know, I met you, and then I went home, and Tom has over the last 25 years collected, videotaped, and collected and curated and put online the oral histories of, how do you know how many?
About a thousand
individual Japanese American people who lived through various experiences, a lot of them during the World War II years. I went home and I started listening to these oral histories, and there were so many just really good, gripping stories in there. And I'm a person that's all about story. I'm drawn to good stories. So that in itself really drew me in. And it was also, they were the kinds of stories I'm naturally drawn to. They were stories about, I was particularly interested in the young men of draft age, right after the beginning of World War II. And I was drawn to them because they were the, in many ways, stories of the same kind of earnest, good-hearted, hardworking young men in this case, confronted with a great difficulty and trying to overcome that difficulty, and the things they had to do to get through their difficult time. It reminded me a little bit actually of The Boys in the Boat in that sort of a general sense. So I was very drawn to the stories right away.
Yeah, it was interesting as you were talking. I remember those early days when we were trying to, you know, figure out what the story was. And what you brought was this perspective that sometimes I lose sight of, because I've been so kind of focused on Japanese American history and the stories. What you helped me see was what I was dealing with was actually an American story, a big right. American story, not just a Japanese American story. Right. And I really, you know, appreciated that you were you gave that perspective, as well as the research. You know, earlier this week we were doing a Zoom call, and you know, I had the question like, you know, Tom, why? You know, you work with lots of different authors or a lot of different authors and filmmakers come to Densho for the materials. Why did you spend so much time with this project? And part of it was you, because of your research. I mean, you and your wife would travel, go to not only the Densho archives, but in Los Angeles, like the Japanese American National Museum, Gopher Broke, Hawaii, the Hamilton Library. And pretty soon you're coming back with all this interesting information. So I just love the two of us just sitting here talking about stories. But it got hard because the story's so big. And talk about how you decided what the story was going to be for Facing the Mountain.
It was, you know, there's so much material there. And there's so many, as I say, good stories, interesting stories, important stories. I knew I had to narrow it down. So what I decided eventually was, what I alluded to before was, I decided to focus on the dilemma that young Japanese American men of draft age, the dilemma they confronted immediately after Pearl Harbor. Here, the situation for them was their families were being incarcerated. They were being forced out of their homes. They were having to sell their possessions for pennies on the dollar or simply give them away. They were having to walk away from their schooling. And yet at the same time, some of them wanted, like millions of other young American men, felt they should do something for their country. And some of them wanted to volunteer for the American military. They were told they were not able to volunteer for the American military simply because of their Japanese ancestry. So what do you do if you're a young man in that situation? So the story evolved around four young men, but it's important, I think, to note that it's also very much about their families. It's about their immigrant parents' experiences coming from Japan, trying to make their way either in Hawaii or on the mainland of the United States. So it's really, the four young men are the nucleus of the story, but their families and other people come into play along the way.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned these four young men, and let's show the first image. This is of Gordon Hirabayashi. And, you know, when we talk about the men, this first one we're talking about actually didn't serve in the 442nd, didn't do military service. He actually took a very different path. And here he is with, I think, his wedding with Esther Schmo. But talk about Gordon, why you included him in the story.
Yeah, Gordon, as you know, because you spent many hours talking to him, Gordon was a really interesting man. His situation was, at the beginning of the war, he was a student at the University of Washington. And he was also a Quaker and a conscientious objector before the war even began. When the war broke out, amongst other things, a curfew was imposed on anybody of Japanese ancestry in the city of Seattle. One of the first things Gordon did was decide he just wasn't going to obey that curfew. And we'll see him talk about that in a minute, I think. But then subsequently, and he began to document the occasions on which he was out violating the curfew. And then a little later, he, when the time came for Japanese Americans in Seattle to get on the buses and be taken away to these camps, Gordon didn't get on the bus. Instead, he sat down and wrote a very detailed, carefully reasoned statement about why he felt that the curfew and the incarcerations were wrong and illegal and unconstitutional. And he took that statement. He went downtown Seattle. He walked into the FBI office in Seattle, and he turned himself in. And that, of course, began a long legal battle that saw Gordon in and out of jail and prison through the rest of the war. Mm.
So we're going to show a clip, but before I do that, I just wanted to mention one of the things I've really enjoyed is your use of oral histories. We have so many of them, but you know they're interesting because you get a flavor of you know, the personnel, and it is about this time when he decided that he was going to defy the curfew and then later on the exclusion order. And he's now figuring out what he's going to do.
And then one day, I'm dashing home. Hey, Gordon, it's 5 to 8. I grab my stuff and it takes about 5 minutes to get home. So I'm just dashing home. And it hit me. A question that I should have faced earlier just hit me. How come I'm dashing home and all your timekeepers are still there? It just needed the question to be raised. I knew I couldn't answer it, you know, without saying I can't do it. I turned around and went back to the library. Hey, what's the matter? And I said, well, you guys are here. We got work to do. I said, I got work to do too. I decided if you guys are here, I'm gonna work with you. I'll go back when you guys are ready to go. Nobody turned me in. And I didn't take that until it hit me. And when it hit me, I knew, gosh, I can't do it. That's two-faced.
Yeah, I really like that clip because you can see, you know, the principled stand that Gordon took. And it took a lot of courage. Let me move on to the other three right now because they exhibited a different type of courage. And, mm-hmm. and all three of the next men we're going to talk about served in the 442nd. So let's go from Seattle to Hawaii and show an image of the next person, Katsugo Miho, his nickname being Cats Miho. And here's a picture of him in a football uniform. But tell me about Cats Miho and why he was included.
Yeah, so Cats grew up on Maui at a time when Maui, like most of the Hawaiian Islands, were essentially large sugarcane and pineapple plantations. And of course, the plantations were very racially stratified, and the working conditions, particularly for Issei immigrants, were really brutal in the cane fields. But Katz, at the beginning of the war, actually was a student at the University of Hawaii in Honolulu. And he actually witnessed the attack on Pearl Harbor from the roof of his residence hall. And upon seeing this, he ran across the street. Because he was enrolled at the university, he was a member of the ROTC, the Reserve Officer Training Corps. He ran across the street and joined dozens or hundreds of other young ROTC cadets on the campus, most of them Japanese Americans. And they were quickly formed into something called the Hawaii Territorial Guard. So that night, and they were issued guns that they did not know how to use. And so that night, Katz found himself down on the waterfront in Honolulu, patrolling the waterfront, guarding against what everybody expected would be an invasion by Japanese imperial forces at any moment. Unfortunately, as we're going to see in a clip here in a moment, I think, his time in the Territorial Guard was cut short.
So let's show this clip. So go ahead and show the clip of Cats Miho talking about the Hawaii Territorial Guard.
Our group of University of Hawaii students were dropped off as guards over a area in the dark on 4-hour shifts. And for 2-3 nights in a row, we were serving as, I don't know what we would have done because we were given a loaded rifle. We were given a loaded rifle with 5 rounds of ammunition. We didn't even know how to fire the gun. But we were given this rifle. We were told, you load it this way, and this is the way how you lock it in case anything happens. And to this day, I wonder, what was if anything happened was what they were referring to, because not that nothing happened, but what if anything had happened, what were we supposed to do because we were not giving any kind of orders. A month and a half later, early in the morning, we got called up and said, hey, we're going to report down to Nanakila Intermediate School. We woke up at about 2 o'clock in the morning. They woke us up at 2 o'clock. And then finally, about 5:30, a truck came by to pick us up. We all fully packed and everything. They dropped us off at London Keela. We wondered what was going on. We found out that the whole battalion was assembled at London Keela. And then Major Frazier, who was the adjutant commander of the battalion, came up and told us point blank, right in straight in our face, says, the reason why you are here this morning is because you, all you Americans or Japanese, I'm pretty sure he referred to it, Americans or Japanese ancestry, because of your ethnic background, you are being discharged herein, right off the bat, right as of now, you are being discharged from the Hawaiian Territory. Only the AJAs. And completely stayed a shock.
I really like that clip. And I should mention that that interview was done at the Center for Oral History at the University of Hawaii by Warren Nishimoto and his wife, Michiko Kodama Nishimoto. But, you know, so much personality, and it's interesting. Every time I watch a clip, you know, new thoughts come up. And some of the things in your book came to mind in terms of, you know, one, I think you described him as the Japanese Cary Grant in the book.
Some of the girls at both Maui High and University of Hawaii thought he looked like a movie star. Yeah, so that was, he was actually, Katz was really popular. He was the president of the student body at Maui High on Maui, of course. Very popular, very outspoken, very articulate young man, and a lot of leadership potential that he showed up later in life. But that night, or that pre-dawn darkness, what a slap to the face. I mean, these guys are out there, they're trying to do something for the country, and suddenly in the dark, they are discharged simply because of their ancestry. And some of those young men could hear other young men in the darkness around them crying that morning. They were so shocked, so devastated. Katz did go on a year later when the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, all Japanese American military unit, was formed. Katz was one of those young men from Hawaii who signed up and joined that unit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I remember that part in the book when you talked about you know, when their rifles were taken away. And and just let people know, I mean, this book, as someone who really knows the stories in the community, it was incredibly emotional. I think you really hit, you know, some of the you know, these strong themes and chords, but, you know, really just this sense of, oh, just the hurt of so many men that, and I remember that scene because it brought tears to my eyes. So let's go to the next man that you talked about. And we're going to, you know, Rudy Tokiwa, which you know, just came up, and Rudy's the soldier in front, but he grew up in California in Salinas. So talk about Rudy.
Yeah, so Rudy grew up on a farm in Salinas. His family was incarcerated first at the Salinas Rodeo Grounds, and then they were sent to a camp in Poston, Arizona, a particularly hot, bleak, desolate camp. I think it may have been the largest of the camps. He was one of the young men who volunteered for the 442nd Regimental Combat Team out of the camp. There was a lot of discussion within the camp amongst the young men about whether the right thing to do was to sign up for this new all Japanese American unit, or to resist the government forces that had incarcerated them and their families. Rudy was one of those that signed up and wound up fighting in Europe. He was a real interesting character. His army name was Punch Drunk. He tended to get in trouble a lot. He didn't always follow the rules, but he was a really colorful character, really interesting guy. And he had just an enormous, enormous heart. And that's what really drew me to him.
Mm. So we're going to show a clip of Rudy, but before we go there, you know, talk a little bit. He joined the 442nd, as did Katz Miho, but you know, this was a segregated Japanese American infantry unit, and talk a little bit about that, and in particular, the the fighting they did in the Vosges Mountains in that kind of October 1944 timeframe.
Right. So the 442nd was sent first to Italy, and they fought their way from Anzio north up to the Arno River. Series of pitched battles against German forces. They were always fighting their way uphill to the top of some Tuscan hilltop town or another. But then they were suddenly sent to northern France, to the French-German border, right on the edge of what the Vosges Forest and the Vosges Mountains, very dark, almost impenetrable forest on the German border, French-German border. They were given the task of liberating a town called Bruyère, which was a juncture of a railroad line and some roadways. And they fought tenaciously over several days, took a lot of casualties, but they did liberate this town of Bruyère. They pushed on past Bruyère into the Vosges to a place called Bifontaine and a town called Belmont. And they came to rest there. They were given an opportunity to rest for a night or two. But in the middle of the night, they were awakened and told they had to go back into battle. And what had happened was the commanding general, General Dahlquist, had ordered part of what was called the Texas Division, a unit composed mostly of young men from Texas and Oklahoma. He had sent the Texans out on the end of a long ridge line, further out than he should have. And they got cut off and surrounded by the Germans. And many of them were wounded. Some of them had gangrene. They began to die. They had very limited medical supplies and no very little food, no drinkable water. So over the course of several days, their situation grew very dire. Dahlquist sent a number of units up into the mountains to try to get breakthrough and get them out, but none of them were able to do so. So finally he awakened the Nisei troops, the 442nd, and sent them up the mountain. I believe first the 2nd Battalion and then the 3rd Battalion. And two of the guys I'm following, Rudy and another man named Fred Chiyosaki, were part of that endeavor. They fought under absolutely hellacious conditions, fought their way up the mountain through, finally did reach the Texas, the stranded Texans, and rescued them. But at absolutely staggering cost, they took enormous casualties. And it was really, really sort of the apex of their battle experience, I think, this rescue of the Lost Battalion, they called it.
Yeah, it was so difficult for me to read those passages because, you know, not only was the fighting brutal, but, you know, I think what Dahlquist had this unit do, you know, not only, you know, after the Bruyères and Bifontaine, which at that point they had taken so many casualties, they should have been pulled off the line and, mm-hmm. and rested. But then the rescue of the Lost Battalion, again, tremendous amount of casualties. And then even then they weren't pulled off. They were ordered to keep pushing for over a week. Yep. And after all that, you know, they had what was called a retreat parade, and General Dahlquist wanted to address the troops. You know, at full strength, the 442nd is about 4,000 men. Mm-hmm. On that day, after all that fighting, there was less than 1,000 men, less than a battalion left standing. And so this next clip we're going to see is of Rudy Tokiwa talking about, you know, that retreat parade. So let's show this clip.
The 36th Division commander wanted the 442nd to pass in review. And he said, all personnel of the 442nd will pass in review. So the 442nd passes in review. And like I say, you got three battalions plus headquarters. And they don't even have a battalion out there passing in review. So General Dahlquist turned around and he said to the colonel, when I order everyone to pass in review, I mean the cooks and everybody will pass in review. And Chaplain Yamada said, this is the first time I saw the colonel cry. And he said, "This is all I have left."
You know, I've seen that clip, you know, dozens and dozens of times. And, you know, I did that interview with Rudy, so I spent many hours with him. And, you know, he was kind of a tough guy.
Yeah, he was.
And when I interviewed him, it just surprised me so much when he started crying.
Yeah.
And it was a really, really, you know, I get choked up now thinking about that.
You know, it was when I'm pretty sure I could confirm this with my wife last night, actually. She reminded me that I showed that clip to my wife, Sharon, early on in the process. And that was really, I think, the moment at which I decided I was going to do this book, if I could pull it off. She had the same reaction. She teared up. I teared up just watching that clip. As I say, Rudy, as you say, Rudy was, he was a tough guy, very tough guy, but he also had this big heart, this, you know, ability to empathize, and this tender side. And yeah, so in many ways, that clip, I think, was the genesis of the book, mm-hmm. which I had thought that was true, but I confirmed it with Sharon last night.
Yeah, I mean, if Rudy were alive, he would, you know, I mean, that'd be so meaningful to him. So from Rudy, let's go to the fourth man, Fred Shiosaki, and this in Spokane, Washington. And just, you know, briefly, in Washington State, which is a little different than California, they actually divided the state in half, where there's Western Washington and Eastern Washington. And on Western Washington, you know, closer to the ocean, Japanese Americans were removed and incarcerated. On Eastern Washington, Japanese Americans were allowed to stay in their homes. They had to, you know, kind of follow curfews and things like that. But Fred grew up in Spokane, which was not an exclusion zone. So talk about Fred Shiosaki.
Yeah, Fred's family ran a laundry in a neighborhood called Hilliard in Spokane, down by the railroad tracks. And they lived in an apartment over the laundry. And Hilliard was a pretty rough neighborhood. It was largely immigrants from all over the world, really, working on the railroad there. And because it was very ethnically mixed, a lot of racial slurs got thrown around. And Fred was a young man who, he didn't really like to fight. He was actually sort of intrinsically a gentle, soft-spoken man, but he could not abide racial slurs. And when they were hurled at him, he would fight you. In fact, he got in scraps so often with neighborhood kids that his eyeglasses kept getting broken, and he had to keep going to his father to try to get him to buy yet another pair of eyeglasses because he'd been in another fight. Fred, when the war broke out, Fred immediately tried to enlist. Went down to the Selective Service office in Spokane, tried to enlist, was told he couldn't do that, that he was an enemy alien, which utterly shocked him. So he spent the next year at Gonzaga University feeling terrible because all the other young men in Spokane had gone off to war. But then in early 1943, when the 442nd was created, he did immediately enlist and became a member of K Company and was one of those who went up that mountain after the Texans.
Okay, so the clip we're going to show of Fred is the war has ended in Europe, and he's on his way back to Spokane. And he's on a train, he was taking the train, and he stops at Union Station in Washington, D.C., where he meets another soldier. So let's show this clip.
I was on the train by myself, and we stopped in Washington, D.C. From that railroad station, you could see the Capitol building. I'm sure that must have been the Union Station. And I was sitting there looking out the window, and this GI came out, I think he's a buck sergeant, and he stopped, and he looked at me, and he looked at my patch. He says, "Hey, you were the 442nd. Yeah. He says, "Were you at the Lost Battalion?" And I said, "Yeah, I was there." He says, "I was in there."
So he was one of the 200 men that you rescued?
Yeah. It's one of those things. I could just feel myself getting really, I was angry. God, and I turned to him and I said, Do you know how many men we lost? We lost getting you guys out of there. You know how many of my friends died in there? And, well, he said, you know, if you guys were in there, we'd have come after you. And I shook my head and I said, well, he said, anyway, I want to thank you, you know. He put out his hand and I turned away and looked out the window.
You know, I like that clip because it surprised me when Fred turned away. And I asked him about this because Fred's a very proud young man and very principled. And he did talk about how he was in some ways ashamed that he wasn't able to shake that soldier's hand. But he said it was just so raw. It was just so hard. And talk about that and how he suffered after the war.
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of these guys and like a lot of World War II vets in general, they came home with psychological wounds as well as physical wounds in many cases. Fred's moved back into the laundry for a while, the apartment over the laundry. And I know that his mother a number of times had to awaken him in the middle of the night because he was screaming. He obviously had PTSD from his experiences. So he carried a lot of pain back home with him. And I think probably took a long time to work through that and, you know, come to some kind of peace with it. But as I say, and unfortunately, Fred just passed away a couple of weeks ago, which is really sad for me because I had the opportunity, and I know you spent time with him. I also had the opportunity to get to know him personally a little bit. And I'll never forget when I first met him, I went to the retirement home where he was living, and I stuck out my hand and said, I'm so proud to meet you, so honored to meet you. And he shook his head and said, no, I'm honored to meet you. And I just couldn't believe this decorated war hero was responding to me that way. There was this kind of humility and graciousness. So anyway, I miss Fred.
Mm, yeah, no, I do too. And yeah, such a humble guy. And you know, and I just want to mention, you know, the gratitude part in terms of the Lost Battalion guys. And I was telling you the story before that I just found out this week with my dad. So you know, one of the things you know the book has done for me is, it's, you know, it's created a dialogue. You know, my dad got the book, he read it in 3 days, and he was really proud of that. But we start talking about it, and he shared a story in his way. So he was a World War II vet too, but he was younger and he was training in Texas a few months after the Rescue Lost Battalion. And, you know, whereas Fred kind of mentioned that, you know, maybe doubting whether or not how much gratitude, you know, the Lost Battalion guys did. You know, when my dad was in Texas, there was a woman behind a counter at a store, and she noticed my dad had a loose button. And she looked at my dad and says, you know, are you Japanese American? And he said, yes. And he said, well, take your coat off and let me fix your button. And as she was fixing the button, she told my dad that, you know, she was so grateful because of what the 442 did, because a close relative was actually in the Lost Battalion. And as my dad was, you know, telling me this, and this is why I'm getting choked up, my dad got really choked up about that. And he recognized, you know, how much what the 442, you know, did and the gratitude other people had, and that really meant a lot to him.
Yeah, there is a bond now between Texas and the 442 guys. In fact, I don't remember what year it was, but Governor Connally eventually proclaimed all the 442 and 100th Infantry Battalion men, the Nisei soldiers, honorary citizens of Texas, which for Texans is a big deal, I think. So that was really cool.
Yeah. So we have those kind of stories, but you also in the book, you know, talk about issues of racism, and I want to go back in some ways to, you know, frame it in terms of when you're writing this book. You know, in the last five and a half years, a lot was going on in our country. I remember when we first started talking about, you know, this story, we had things going on that very much rhymed with some of the racism that we saw during World War II. You know, for example, the Muslim travel ban, where, you know, a whole segment of people were being denied, you know, access to the United States, primarily because of the religion. And they were saying that, well, this was because of national security, which was very similar in my ear to the rationale against Japanese Americans saying, well, it's a military necessity that we round them up and put them, you know, behind barbed wires. And then later on, when I saw the detention and separation of families at our southern border and looked at the camps that they were being in, it was again reminiscent of the, you know, the American concentration camps that held Japanese Americans. And I should mention my terminology. I use the term American concentration camp. You know, the term concentration camp was used by people like, you know, President Roosevelt, politicians, even Supreme Court justices when they ruled on Korematsu, you know, used the term concentration camp. It wasn't until, you know, people learned more about, you know, the death camps in Germany, the Nazi death camps, that they kind of moved away from that terminology. But going back to my question, as all these things were happening in our world as you're writing, how did that impact your writing of the book?
Yeah, I mean, it was remarkable. The entire time I was researching and writing, there were echoes of the past in what I was seeing on the evening news. When I was reading about these hardworking immigrant families from Japan trying to make their way in America, was at the same time that the travel ban about, and not just travel ban, but all this rhetoric about immigrants was surfacing. And when, as you say, families were being torn apart at the southern border, I was reading and talking to people about families being dislocated and torn apart by the incarceration in the camps. And there were continuing echoes all through the last 4.5 years or so that I was working on the book. But there was something else also that that was powerful for me. I thought I knew quite a bit about the history of anti-Asian sentiment in this country, having grown up in California. But I didn't really realize the extent of it until I was doing the research for this book. And you know, I learned about, for instance, the violence directed against Chinese immigrants when they came to California for the gold rush in the 1850s. There were lynchings and burnings and people driven out of their homes. And then there was this era called the Yellow Peril around the turn of the 20th century, when the news media and Hollywood were perpetuating these images of Asians as locusts and rats and snakes and bringers of disease. And these were really, you know, vile racist images and tropes. And then when I was researching Pearl Harbor and the immediate aftermath, those same images and tropes, literally those same images, were being brought out again, those same associations. And that in itself was interesting to me, that these ideas have been embedded in the American consciousness for so long, and they keep getting sort of pulled up and recycled. And then, of course, I think just recently, over the last 4 or 5 years, and especially the last 4 or 5 months, we've seen the same thing again in regards to COVID, where these images and these associations with disease and so forth are being weaponized, but they were already there. They're already something that has been in the American consciousness for a long time. So it was eye-opening for me.
Mm-hmm. And I like in your book that you bring these issues up, you know, the racism. You don't necessarily hit people over the head with it, but I remember, you know, reading the book, and you get so interested in the personal stories, and that in some cases almost overwhelms you as you go through that. But then as you take a step back, you realize, oh, you know, Dan talked about things like, you know, Japanese Americans helping to liberate, you know, death camps in Germany, while their families are in these camps, in the United States, or the issues around the bombing of Hiroshima and all that. There's all of those things that were there. You know, before we go on, I just wanted to invite the viewers. If you have any questions for Dan or me, you know, go ahead and put it in chat or the Q&A, and we'll try to get to them. But while we're waiting for those, you know, I wanted, you know, going back to the 442, they were really highly decorated. And during the war, there was one man who received the Medal of Honor. And there's a Los Angeles connection here. So I thought I could have you talk about, Sadao Munimori was the, during World War II, during that era, the only Japanese American who received the Medal of Honor. Later on, more were awarded. But talk about Sadao Munimori.
Yeah, so Munimori was an incredible young man. I took a tour of battlefields in Italy with some of the sons and daughters of 442 vets. And there is in the little town of Pietrasanta a statue to Sadao Munimori. And he, as you say, he's the only one of them who won the Medal of Honor during the war period. How he won that medal or why it was awarded to him is extraordinary if you read this story. There came a point at which the 442nd were trying to break through what was called the Gothic Line in northern Italy, which involved climbing up abrupt mountainsides and surprising the Germans, basically, and overwhelming them and breaking open this defensive position. As part of that, Sadao actually was part of the 100th Infantry Battalion, which was, I probably should have explained earlier, the 442nd, along with the 442nd, with the 100th Infantry Battalion, was an all-Japanese American unit that had been formed out of Japanese Americans who had already been in the service at the beginning of the war. So they were essentially the first battalion of the 442nd. Sadao was part of the 100th Infantry Battalion. As they went up the mountain early, the pre-dawn darkness of the day they were assaulting the line, he crawled forward and through hurling hand grenades against an almost impenetrable defensive position, took out several machine gun nests. And then he began to crawl back towards where his companions were sheltering in a shell crater. And he had almost made it back to this shell crater when a grenade bounced off of his helmet and into this crater where two of his companions were taking shelter. He got up into machine gun fire, hurled himself on top of the grenade. The grenade detonated and he was killed. And it's just one of those moments like just complete selflessness. He just gave himself entirely to saving his companions.
Yeah, no, it's, there's, I read an account from his sister, his older sister. And when they were growing up, I guess the sister could actually in some ways, kind of beat him up a little bit. And so there was a time when Sadao was pretty upset and said, one day they're gonna name a ship after me. And the sister kind of poo-pooed that and said, then if that's the case, I'll never step foot on it. There's kind of sibling rivalry. After he was killed, one of the troop ships returning to, and she lived in Hawaii at the time, returning to Hawaii, they named after Munimori. And so she writes about that and how touched she was that they did that. So,
the Medals of Honor came very slow for some of these men, considering the heroics that they displayed. It took decades in many cases for the 442 to really be given the honors that they were due for a variety of reasons. And there are some absolutely amazing stories of heroism that come out of those incidents. He was the first, and boy, it's really something to contemplate what that young man did.
Yeah, yeah. There's a question from the audience, and it's one that you cover quite a bit. When we talked about, Katz Miho from Hawaii, and you have Rudy and Fred from the mainland. What a lot of people don't realize was there was a lot of tension between, the Hawaiians called the mainlanders katongs, the sound I heard of like a coconut hitting the head or something, or a head hitting the ground. And the Japanese Americans on mainland, for a reason, called the Hawaiians Buddha heads.
Right.
And there's a lot of tension between them. Talk a little bit about that, and what were some of the things that changed over time?
Yeah. So when the group from Hawaii came together with the young men from the mainland. They all came together for basic training at Camp Shelby in Mississippi. And oh boy, it was like mixing oil and water. Fist fights broke out all over camp within the first few days. Part of the problem was that there's just sort of cultural differences between growing up in a plantation town in Hawaii and growing up in Los Angeles and going to UCLA, for instance. But one of the roots of the problem was that the kids from Hawaii, the young men from Hawaii, universally spoke pidgin English. And the mainland guys just simply could not understand what they were saying. And that made the guys from Hawaii feel disrespected. And so this tension arose between them on that level. They couldn't communicate. They had sort of different attitudes also towards life and participating in the war. A lot of the young men from the mainland had come out of the camps, and they felt that they had a righteous cause here. They were very serious about what they were doing in terms of wanting to prove their loyalty and earn respect for Japanese Americans in general. And the Hawaii guys, by and large, many of them were kind of oblivious to they knew the camps existed, but they really didn't feel it. They didn't internalize it. So the two groups were having such a hard time getting along that the commanders were considering disbanding the 442nd. Until actually, I believe it was Chaplain Higuchi, who got the idea. Well, let's take the Hawaii guys to one of the camps and show them what's happening there. So the army began to take busloads of the young men from Hawaii. There were two camps in Arkansas nearby. They took busloads of them to these camps in Arkansas. And these guys were horrified seeing all these men, women, and children living behind barbed wire. They were in uniform, but they were frisked before they could go into the camp. And they were just horrified and disgusted by what they saw there. So as they came back to Camp Shelby, they began to have more of an appreciation for what the mainland guys were doing. In the meantime, the mainland guys learned to speak pidgin, and that helped things along. So, you know, by the time they got into combat, these guys were knit together really, really closely, and they became one of the most coherent and effective fighting forces in American history.
You always like sometimes from a storyteller that tension, you know, that things like that bring together. You know, something else that another question that comes up is you talk a lot. You know, the four main people you highlight in the book are men. But in the book, there, you know, people have asked, well, how is the story of the women represented in the book? Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I know they're in there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the book is very much is intended to also to be about the families, because the families are the context for these young men's lives. So I do talk about the mothers and the sisters and aunties of these young men and what it was like both to live in the camps or to have young sons or brothers go off to war. And that's very important part of it. One person in particular that was interesting to me was Katsumiho's sister, Fumie. Fumie had gone to Japan shortly before the war began. When the war started, she was basically stranded in Japan. So she saw life sort of deteriorate in Japan as the war unfolded. And so we see her at the beginning of the book, living in Japan when Pearl Harbor happens. And later in the book, towards the end, as the firebombing of Tokyo and other cities takes place, Fumie and she was living with another sister and her husband. They moved to a village near Hiroshima. Fumie had a job in downtown Hiroshima. The morning of the dropping of the atomic bomb, she actually missed her train into the city. So while she was waiting for the next train into the city, she saw the bombing and she saw the mushroom cloud. And she didn't know what it was. Nobody had ever seen anything like that. And so the next day, she went, when the trains got running, she was able to get close enough to downtown Hiroshima to walk into what was left of the city. And she spent several days wandering around in the ruins of Hiroshima, trying to help people. She was trying to find this coworker that I don't believe she ever did find, but she also found herself nursing and trying to take care of the victims of the bombing. So it makes an interesting sort of bookends to the story, and also just a different view than we have often had of that part of the story.
Mm. Yeah, thank you. Here's a question from the audience from Lauren that has a connection to the story. She writes, my great uncle was in the 442nd and killed in Italy around the same time as Munemori. A joint funeral service was held at Manzanar for my uncle Munemori and another 442nd soldier who were killed in action. Their families who were incarcerated attended the funeral service at Manzanar and received the medals posthumously. With so few Nisei remaining, how do we continue to honor their legacy?
That's a really good question. I mean, and that's one thing, well, I know it's one thing your work is all about. It's definitely what my book is intended to do. I mean, these are stories that will fade away if somebody doesn't memorialize them, if they aren't put into books and films and kept alive. History tends to evaporate unless people actively try to keep it alive. And that's why what you've done at Densho is so incredibly important. But you know, Tom, you had a relative in the 442nd also, and maybe you could just tell us a little bit about that, because that's also very touching.
Yeah, it's kind of similar to this story as I was reading it. So my uncle was killed in action, but you know, leading up to it, he was in the ROTC at the University of Washington, was incarcerated at the Minidoka concentration camp. And when he volunteered, he failed the physical. There was something wrong with his test with kidney. And so my grandmother gave him a home remedy that he took that day and then went back, retook the test, and passed. So he went into the 442nd, served in the 100th Battalion, and was killed in action in Italy. And there's this picture, this photograph that my mother showed me of my grandparents receiving the flag at Minidoka. But the story that came out was that was really painful for my mom. Was she said, the day that my grandparents found out, my grandfather was so distraught, so angry. That his oldest son, kind of the pride of the family, was killed. He lashed out at my grandmother, saying, "You killed our son by helping him pass his physical." And the painful thing was, my mother, who was at that time about 15, was there watching this argument between her parents. And I know it's very traumatic for her, and it's hard for her to even think about this, but that was a story that came out because of the sharing of stories that were so important. But there was another similarity. The memorial service for my uncle was the same memorial service for William Kenzo Nakamura, who was another Medal of Honor winner. And in Seattle, the federal courthouse is named after him. And so there's another kind of similarity to that previous question. I think we're at 7 o'clock. And so I think, Ella, did you want to come back and close the show? I think, they say, go ahead and do one more question.
Okay.
So from a Joe, Lumarde says, how were Pan-Asian relationships during this time?
Boy, I'm not sure I'm expert enough in that.
It's kind of interesting. I'm actually, I just reread the book, The Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet. It took place in Seattle, but it was a novel, a story about, in some ways, the relationship between the Chinese community and the Japanese community during World War II. And actually between the different generations, you had the Japanese immigrants and the Chinese immigrants, where the countries they came from were actually at war. Yeah. And there was a lot of hostility between the Japanese and Chinese community that people, you know, didn't really think about, but because oftentimes they think of Asian Americans as kind of being similar, but very much they were very different. But the story is actually revolves around the children of the immigrants, where because they went to school together, they actually became friends. Right. And so there was this difference. Right. So it depends, I guess, is the way to answer that.
That sounds right.
Thank you, both of you. Such a fascinating conversation. I actually didn't want it to end. I wanted it to go on and listen to more stories. And thank you for sharing all those clips, you know, reading about cats and reading about Gordon. It's so great even to see that picture in there and all the pictures that you've included in the book. So Daniel, first of all, thank you so much for bringing this story to life and for really informing so many of us of our history, our Japanese American history, which is American history that we really didn't know about. And Tom, I want to thank you for your project, and please continue doing what you're doing and your commitment and your depth of understanding. You know, it'll just keep on unearthing more and more history for all of us. And to all the people who've been listening, many of you may not have yet bought the book. Just would like to tell you, Romans in Pasadena has many copies waiting for you guys. And thank you all of you for attending. Wish you all a very nice rest of your evening. All of you, stay safe, stay connected, and keep reading. Goodbye.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.